everybody. I'm an addict and alcoholic. My name's Carl. Hey, everybody. So grateful to be here with you tonight. Thank you so kindly, Chris, for offering this invite to me. I got to be honest with you. I sat with this for a while as to whether I should come and speak. You know, there's days where I still, you know, suffer from low self-esteem. I think I don't have that great of a program. I think, you know, I need to impress you guys with, like, some book passages. And I still struggle with that, you know. And luckily I gave it some thought, and Chris has become a good friend of mine. So I'm here to share my experience, strength, and hope. And thank you, Tara, for the introduction. When I came back this time 19 months ago, there was nobody who would have had anything good to say about me at that point. I think probably even my mother wouldn't have had anything good to say with me. I'll get to my story, but when I came back, I'd been to 17 drug treatment centers. I'd been on methadone maintenance. I'd been on Suboxone maintenance. I came back this time suicidal, completely broken, hopeless. And I honestly, I just pretty much resigned myself to the fact that I was going to die of this disease. And so had most of my friends. So had most of my bandmates throughout the years. And, you know, even my mom, who was my, you know, greatest supporter, had slowly, you know, started to pull away. And I'm so grateful to be clean and sober today. So grateful. And so I was born in Prince Edward Island, Canada. And thank you very much. Does anybody even know where that is? It's a little tiny island off Nova Scotia. And their entire economy is potatoes, interestingly enough. And I was born to two people at 14 and 15. I was adopted at 6 months old by my parents. And I was told at 3 years old that I was adopted. You know, and I was told that my name at birth was Sean McMahon. And my parents were 14 and 15. So I'm only assuming, but I think I was a party foul. You know, I think I was a party foul. And I immediately, at 3 years old, got this feeling of being different and not belonging and not knowing where I came from. And that's a feeling that has not entirely disappeared, I got to be honest with you. It stuck with me for a long time. So my mom is a homemaker. She's never worked. My dad is an MIT graduate, a Columbia graduate. He's literally a rocket scientist. The guy built the first transcontinental satellite or a transcontinental radio system over the Alps in Europe, and literally worked on the Apollo 11 mission. And so, needless to say, my dad is a very, very smart guy. My dad is also totally incapable of showing any emotion except for anger, and is very Catholic on top of it. And so is my mom. And they make Rush Limbaugh look liberal. So I'm adopted. I grow up in this crazy Catholic environment with a rocket scientist dad and a very overbearing mother. And it was like the perfect storm of addiction was like already underway. And this is at a young age. When I was 3 years old, I was already sort of ADD. And my parents decided to put a violin in my hands at 3 years old. And it became pretty obvious that I was going to be okay at it, pretty good at it. By the time I was 8 or 9, I was playing semi-professionally. By the time I was 13, I made my Carnegie Hall debut. At 13, as the principal violin. It's hard to look at me, right, and be like, this kid plays the classical violin. People are like, you're full of shit. It's true. And I apologize for the cuss word. And so I was this really high-level violinist, and then I had this home life. And what I learned in my home growing up was that if it looks good on the outside, then it's all good on the inside. My family had a lot of money. On the outside of the house, we had a 5-bedroom house in a very affluent suburb of New York City. We had, you know, cars, My parents sent me to private school, and on the inside of the house, it was absolute hell. It was absolute hell. My dad was physically abusive, emotionally abusive. Until I got sober this time, I don't think I'd ever heard him say, I love you, or I'm proud of you. I don't. I heard a lot that I'm a failure, that I could do better. So I started to buy into all these narratives growing up, that I didn't belong, I wasn't enough, but yet I had this music thing that I was really good at. When I was 12 years old, I lost my virginity to my half-sister, who's also adopted. And I went into this, it was just two kids screwing around, and since I had Catholic parents, I never really got an education on what sex looked like, you know, and so it happened, and I just remember having this incredible amount of shame, you know, carrying around this crazy guilt and shame, and then you add Catholicism to the top of that, it's like, geez, man, it's like a recipe for disaster. And so my parents thought that, you know, I was just acting out, I wasn't, you know, wasn't doing very well in school, and so they decided that the answer to my problems was more Catholicism and stricter Catholicism. And so they sent me to this really weird sect of Catholicism called Opus Dei. And it's a weird sect. These guys beat themselves with thorns to, you know, if they sin. And anyway, the long and the short of it is they took boys on these weekend trips. And I got molested by a priest. And this is when I'm 13 or 14 years old. I didn't speak a word about this until I was 35. I didn't tell a soul. And I was just filled with this incredible guilt, incredible shame. I felt like that I was a castaway. I felt like nobody wanted me. I felt like, you know, my parents had thrown me out. And then you add this other stuff to the mix, and it was like, as soon as I found a drink, it was like, yes, yes. I'll never forget the first time I drank. It was on New Year's Eve. I was 12 or 13, and went over to a friend's house, and we were having champagne toast for New Year's. And they had one glass of champagne, and I had a bottle and a half of champagne, puked on the carpet. And this was a guy who, he was a bodybuilder, and he looked at me like he was going to kill me, and I was like, oh, shit. And he's like, you drank too much, you're an alcoholic. And this is the first time I drank. And I was like, I did what every good alcoholic does. I looked at him, and I'm like, man, I ate some bad seafood for dinner, bro. Wasn't the booze. And like, seriously, you could carry that up until 42 years old. Like, it was bad seafood, dude. Like, I don't think you get it. So, but I remember immediately being able to get out of the world that was reality, and to be able to escape the pain and the suffering and the trauma, and it worked, and it worked. And so immediately, you know, I began drinking as much as I can. My parents sent me to boarding school. I was kicked out of boarding school for sneaking off one of the field trips and going into Hartford, Connecticut, and hanging out with somebody smoking crack all night. You know, and this is at 15 or 16 years old. I barely graduated high school, and it's because I decided it'd be funny my last week of high school to walk through the halls smoking cigarettes. You know? Now, this is having been offered a full scholarship to four of the best music schools in the country. Juilliard, Eastman School of Music, Princeton University School of Music, and Harvard School of Music. And I almost didn't graduate because I was just a little shit, you know. And so I ended up graduating from high school barely. And I went up to school in Rochester, New York at Eastman School of Music. And as soon as I was out of my house with my parents and the Catholicism, it was like, it was game over. And I began to drink all day, every day. When I showed up to class, the teachers used to look at me and be like, is it visitor's day today? I just never showed up. And I spent my days, oh, the other thing, I started smoking weed every day. And so I thought that you could cover up the smell of weed with incense. And it turns out you can't. They banned incense in the dorms of Eastman School of Music in Rochester, New York, thanks to this guy. And the dean calls me after 2 years, and she sits me down, and she says, you know, Mr. Schmidt, you may not be ready for college yet. I'm like, you think? Like, I had a 0.8 grade point average, you know, on a full scholarship. It's unbelievable. And so there were these, like, there were these two versions of Carl. There was this really good classical violinist, and then there was this just crazy party guy, Carl. And it was weird. Nobody could figure it out, because if you guys know, like, most classical musicians are sort of dorky, you know, like, sort of, like, well put together, wearing tuxes and shirts and ties. And I was wearing ripped jeans and drinking and smoking weed. And so I was politely asked to leave college, and I decided in my infinite wisdom that the problem was college. The problem was college. And the solution was Colorado. The solution was Colorado with a couple of my buddies from high school that I drank with. And so we decided we were going to become rock stars and move to Denver. And that's what I did. I packed up a car and I moved to Denver, Colorado. And when I got to Denver, of course, everywhere I went, there I was. And I began to, of course, drink around the block in Colorado. When I was 20 years old, another point in my life is that we went to a party. And it was my buddy Alex's 21st birthday party. And they were passing around a CD case. How many of you remember CD cases? So they were passing around a CD case with this white stuff on it, right? And my friend Alex is like, dude, do not let Carl do one anything off of that CD case. And I was like, what the hell is it, man? You know, like, give me some of that. And I did my first line of blow off of a Grateful Dead CD case in Denver, Colorado. And I'm not even kidding you. I think, like, within 3 weeks, like, my gear was in the pawn shop. Their gear was in the pawn shop. Like, stuff for, like, 6 days at a time. And it was just absolutely crazy. And, like, seriously, it was so bad so quickly. And you know, we were doing pretty well in the music business out there. I mean, we were playing these big festivals, and, like, I just could not hold it together. It didn't matter how much success I had in music. I just could not hold it together. And I've grown to understand that I think the reason why drugs and alcohol were so attractive to me is, like, I did not fit in anywhere. I never felt like I fit in. And the kids who were smoking weed, drinking, and doing blow, like, they accepted me. They were cool with me. And I wasn't cool with me. So I said, you know what, man, like, you guys are going to be cool with me. I want to do whatever you want to do, you know? I want to do whatever makes me cool. It was not cool in seventh grade to play the violin at all. I was wearing these dorky pull-up, like, socks up to my knees and Izod shirts. So dorky. So I'm in Colorado, and after a few years there, it got really bad. It got really, really bad. And, of course, in the middle of winter, I'm pretty much homeless. My car had broken down, doing blow around the clock, and I had about $400 to my name. And I decided that I had figured it out. I knew what the problem was. The problem was Colorado, and the solution was Miami, Florida, with a cocaine habit. And so, literally, oh, by the way, I should tell you, my parents had come out to drop this car off a couple months earlier, and the night before they get there, they say, Carl, we need you to meet us at 8 a.m. to have breakfast. And this is my very conservative parents. And I'm like, sure, I got this. So, of course, I went out to the bar the night before, got hammered. And at about 2 a.m., I came back to my friend's house that I was staying with because I was homeless. And I said, dude, I need some water, Nick, bad. And he's like, go in the fridge, get some water. Just whatever you do, don't drink the open water. Whatever, go in the fridge. And, of course, I drank the one that was open. 4 hours later, I had to meet my parents after doing about 2 gulps of GHB. And, like, literally, like, my eyes were just like this. And my parents are like, do you have a drug problem? Like, I don't know what you're talking about, man. And so I moved to Miami, Florida. And the $500 lasted approximately 2 hours. And I became homeless in Miami, Florida, and I was breaking into parking meters to support my addiction. And I got arrested for breaking into parking meters. years. And I went to Miami-Dade County Jail, where I was labeled the meter man. It was not cool in jail to be the meter man. So I get out of jail after 30 days. They drop the charge, and my parents hadn't heard from me in 5 months at this point. And they started calling the morgues to find me. And I called my parents, and I said, "Mom, you're right. I do have a drug problem, and I need help." And this is in 1999. And they said, "Okay, we're going to pay for your treatment." So I went to my first treatment center in Fort Lauderdale, Florida. And I can't tell you much about that treatment center. It was really, really nice. Really nice. I mean, it was like all the bells and whistles. Like a lot of us that have been to multiple treatment centers, we start like way up here. And gradually the treatment centers get a little bit like way out here. And eventually it was like the bottom for me. But so I went to this treatment center and I get out. And I was introduced to, of course, 12-step recovery. The only thing I remember about that treatment center, other than the really good food and the goldfish pond in the back, is that people took time out of their lives to come to speak to me and give me some hope. And I got out and I did 3 months of sober living. And I remember it's 3 months because he said, "You have to commit to 90 days of sober living." And I said, "I'll do it and not a day more. I'll do it and not a day more." And I did it. And the day I got out, I moved in with some guys that weren't sober and I drank. The day that I moved out. And I was the guy that was in treatment. I was like, "Shh, I don't want you guys to talk about this relapse thing. I got this, dude. You know, I'm good. I'm totally good." And I was convinced that I would never, ever relapse. I just had this unfathomable belief to me that I could ever pick up a drink or a drug again. And I drank the day I got out of sober living. And this began the treatment center tour, I like to call it. And the treatment center tour began in the year 1999, and it actually ended in the year 2017, early last year. And on that treatment center tour, I got to experience every yet that you hear about. I went from being a guy that drank and did lines of coke to eventually, you know, needles in the arm, homelessness, stealing to support my addiction. And what would happen is I would go to these treatment centers, and I was always voted like the client of the month. I was always like the president of the rehab class, you know. I'd call my mom and I'd be like, "Aren't you proud of me? I'm the president of the class," you know. And I would get out of these treatment centers. I'd get out of these treatment centers, and I would do well for 1 month, 2 months, 3 months, 6 months, and then I would just go back to it. Number one, because I never wanted to be sober. Number two, because I never could imagine that I could have a life that was meaningful and fun and fulfilling sober. And I thought that sobriety meant meetings and reading the big book all day and, you know, having to call my sponsor and talk and tattle on myself. And I was like, "This sucks, man. I'd rather get high." And that's what I did. It's exactly what I did. I had no desire to do the work. I had no desire to really get sober. And so as a result, my life got really freaking bad. I would get these great gigs. Over the years, I get to tour with Steve Tyler. I get to tour with Derek Trucks. I get to tour with, you know, some pretty legit musicians. And I would get these incredible gigs. And I would get on the bus and I would, you know, I would tell them I'm in recovery. And that was usually followed with, "But I think I can still smoke weed," or, you know, "Once in a while, I think I can drink. Just keep the coke away from me and I'll be good." Or, "Whatever you do, don't give me any of your Xanax," or, "Don't give me any of your Percadoodles. I'll be good." And of course, I got high, and then I just went straight to my drug of choice. Always, every time. So the consequences started stacking up. I began to get arrested. But I had this violin, and I'll show you guys a story of my entitlement. I was on probation for a possession of cocaine charge. And they put me on drug offender probation in Florida, which is no joke. And, of course, I relapsed, and I went to the county over, and I got pulled over, and I had more coke in the car. And they gave me a second possession of cocaine charge, as well as a violation of probation. And the judge really doesn't like it when you violate with the same charge they put you on. And so I got put on double secret drug offender probation, which was just a giant pain in the neck. And I got this gig offer up in New Orleans. And this was a band that's pretty well known, and I really wanted to go on tour with these guys. And I called my lawyer and I said, "Bill, you know, I got this really cool gig offer. What do you think? Can you get me off probation?" And he said, "Bring your violin to court on Monday." And I go to court on Monday, and it just happens to bring your daughter to work day, and the judge has a kid, and I sashay up to the, you know, play the cute kid song or something. The judge is like, "Oh, let him off probation." And my lawyer's like, "That's pretty cool." And at the time, I was like, "That's pretty cool." And I looked back and I was like, that was the problem. You know, it was like this entitlement. Like, somehow the fact that I could play music, like, entitled me to be treated differently. I was at that same court. And when I got sentenced to probation, never forget this. There was a kid in the back who was 20 years old. He was a black kid. He was 20 years old. Had the same exact charge as me. Same exact situation as me. And I got off probation. I was sitting in the back afterwards. I was like, "Thank God." See, like, I prayed and it worked out. This kid's mom came up to me and she's like, "Nothing. My son just got 2 years in state penitentiary, you know, for the same exact charge that I have, you know." And so this entitlement thing really, really worked against me. And so when I was about 30, I tried heroin for the first time. And the first time I tried heroin, I fell down 3 flights of stairs. Nobody had told me about the nod. And I got to the top of the stairs, and I just fell 3 flights of stairs into a rose garden, laughing hysterically with my arm fractured in like 4 places. I mean, I'm a violinist, you know, this is my moneymaker. And I go to the hospital, and they draw blood. Say, "Congratulations, Mr. Schmidt, you tested positive for every single drug that we're testing for." And they put me on, of course, opiate painkillers, and that's really where the slide started. All I can tell you is that, like, you know, I've been in hell, and this is a special part of hell because I developed a physical habit. And as soon as I got sick for the first time, I absolutely knew I was never going to be dope sick again, and I was going to do whatever I could to make sure that I never became dope sick again. It was crazy. I would get on methadone maintenance. I got thrown off the methadone clinic at 120 milligrams a day because I kept popping positive for other drugs. And they didn't even fasting talk to me. They threw me out. And I went to AA, and I sat in AA rooms shaking and shivering for 45 days. Thought I was going to die. And I get done with that, and I went back out and got high a month later. You know, and this is my life, you know. It was like getting little periods of sobriety and then going back out and effed up. And so I got back. I'm going to fast forward a little bit because I don't like speaking that long. I think I like to keep it about 30 minutes. So I get to Austin, Texas, and I called, and honestly, I was absolutely hopeless when I got to Austin a year, almost 2 years ago from November. And I was coming off some hard stuff. I was coming off of Suboxone maintenance, and I was coming off of Xanax. And the entire 37 days I was there, I was kicking. I was miserable. Matter of fact, my therapist that saw me that miserable sitting in the room tonight, and actually, funny enough, one of the other people that saw me when I was that miserable was in the room tonight too. And I was angry, and I was sick, and I was miserable, and suicidal, like I said. And I get through treatment in 37 days, and they said, "Carl, you really should do sober living. You really should come to Austin, Texas, and you should really recreate your life." And I said, "Sober living, 42 years old, thanks but no thanks. Austin, Texas, you guys are the reason why Donald Trump's elected. Like, no thanks. I think I'll go back to Asheville, North Carolina." And that's what I did. I didn't take their suggestion. I went back there and I almost died. What happened is I came back. I called a friend that I'd met in treatment and I said, "Dude, I'm willing to do whatever it takes." And that was March 3rd of last year. And I haven't picked up a drink or drug since that day. And I came back to Austin, humbled, humiliated, and I knew I needed to do something different. Knew it. And the big thing for me was like, if recovery was just about meetings and step work, like it wasn't going to work for me. I needed something more than that. And I came back to Austin, and I took their suggestion. I went to Brightside Sober Living for 9 months. I got an amazing sponsor. This guy allowed me to have a totally different experience with the steps. And what that looked like was when we get to my third step, and you know, I'm recovering Catholic, so I don't like Judeo-Christian language. And we read the book, and he goes, read that paragraph in the third step prayer. And what it says is the wording was quite optional as long as we expressed, you know, without reservation. What he had me do is write a third step song for him. He had me go up to Native American land up in Lampasas and sing this third step song to him. This guy met with me every Monday for 4 hours after working in treatment all day. And I wanted what he had. I wanted his relationship. I wanted what he did for a living. He wasn't just a guy that had read a book. This guy had a life that I wanted. And so I was willing to do what he told me to do. When I was writing out my inventory, I wrote my resentments out. And I didn't have that many. I thought, you know what? I'm not really that resentful. And this is the kind of guy my sponsor is. He looks at my list of maybe 10 or 12 resentments and goes, that's cool. He's like, now I want you to write about all the people who have ever had a resentment against you. And I'm like, shit. And really, it was almost everybody I'd ever come in contact with my whole life had had some sort of a negative experience with me. And that's the truth. I caused wreckage and havoc and damage to almost everybody I'd ever come in contact with. So I get through the steps, and I had a sort of a shift in my thinking. I'd always sort of been big in the meditation and mindfulness thing and sort of had explored Buddhism as a maybe alternative, just because I had such a bad experience with Christianity, you know? And so I started doing another program called Refuge Recovery, which I'm very involved in Austin at this point. It basically, the biggest difference between AA and Refuge would be Refuge believes that all beings have the power and potential to heal themselves and to free themselves from suffering. And what my sponsor had me do with 2 weeks over was he said, Carl, I want you to take your violin and I want you to go call an old folks home up in Round Rock that can't afford music. And I want you to just go up there and I want you to play some violin for these folks. And I don't want you to tell them that you're an addict or an alcoholic. I just want you to go do it. And I said, okay, I'll do it. And I brought a couple of my friends up with me. And we played for about 15 senior citizens. And the magic happened that day for me. For all they cared, I could have been George Strait walking in this place. And I played the music, and I left, and I started crying. And I hadn't cried in a long time. My friend that went with me, Jason, some of you guys remember him, moved back to Oklahoma and over there was last October, and he's my best friend in Austin. Over Christmas last year, I put a Facebook post up asking if people wanted some free live music for the Christmas season, and I got a response from a teacher out in Smithville. And she said, you know, my name's so-and-so. I have a group of special needs kids. And not only are their special needs, but their families are, you know, very, very poor. One kid for Christmas wanted a chocolate shake. A chocolate shake. And his family couldn't afford a chocolate shake. And first of all, I was like, holy shit. You know, I didn't know that people like that, you know, that people existed like this. I put another Facebook post up. I asked the teacher for a list of things that these kids wanted for Christmas. And I get this list back, and it's like a belt. Pencils for school. Like, I'd have been like, give me an Xbox or something, you know? And these kids want a pencil and a belt. So I put a Facebook post up. A number of my friends from around the country sent about $2,500 worth of Amazon stuff to these kids. And we took a druggy buggy, and we jumped in there with about 10 musicians, and we went out and played Santa Claus for these kids. And it's still very emotional. It occurred to me that this is what I'm supposed to be doing, and that this is what recovery is. Recovery is not about memorizing a paragraph in the book. Recovery is about my daily walk. Recovery is about what I do outside of these meetings, you know? It has nothing to do with the meetings. And I think I had gotten so caught up in trying to be a big shot in AA, talk like I knew something, you know? And then I would leave the meetings and I would act like a jerk, you know? So I do this, and I thought to myself, I was like, this is a really cool idea for a nonprofit. Why don't we get musicians or artists that are in recovery? Why don't we go out and just do community service, like play concerts for kids or for old people or for people that can't afford it? And in classical music, there's a little note called the grace note. And the grace note is integral to the music, but it's often overlooked. And so I called this the Grace Notes Project. And I got a bunch of my friends that were in recovery to play music together, and I started doing these outreaches. And I thought, man, when I get a year sober, I want this to be an actual thing. Today, I have a 501c3. This is actually a large part of what I do for a living. Because I go out and I play free concerts for people that can't afford it. And I get to teach kids that can't afford lessons. And I get to be a functioning member of society. And I get to not act like a jerk most of the time. I gotta say, I started working in treatment when I was about 10 months sober. I started as a house manager. It's like, never, ever, ever do that again. And I learned how the odd side of things works. And now, guys, check this out. So today, this is my job. Today, I did a 90-minute meditation workshop with some empowered Buddhist meditation teachers. I went to our detox, and I played Mozart and Bach for people coming off of heroin and dope. And wouldn't you know, I do a check-in with them before, and I do a check-in with them afterwards as to, like, their anxiety and their depression and withdrawal symptoms. Turns out, the classical music actually helps with that stuff, you know? Like, look at me now, Mom. All that money you spent on me when I was growing up, and now I'm playing classical music that people can't even go. It's badass. It really is. I'm a big proponent of whatever works for you guys. I know a lot of people with great sobriety in AA. I know a lot of people with great sobriety in NA. I know a lot of people in refuge recovery that have kick-ass sobriety. I know a lot of people in Celebrate Recovery. I know a lot of people that do Sweat Lodge. I guess my message is that there's no one right way and wrong way to get clean and sober. And I think for me, like, I took whatever talent I might have been given, and I incorporated it as part of my daily practice. And I made it, you know, pretty much my recovery, you know, and it's the only thing I've done differently, and it's worked, you know. I can't tell you the last time that I've really craved a drink or a drug. It's almost like an afterthought at this point. Have there been days where I've thought about it? Yes, but I haven't craved it in a long time. And I never could get past 3 months without craving a drug. Didn't matter how many meetings I went to. Didn't matter how fast I worked the steps or slow. I craved it. And all I did differently was took this music thing and used it to start healing. And the result has been magic. The last year, I've lost 18 friends to overdose or suicide. And it's like every day that I open Facebook, I see another one of my brothers or sisters that's gone. You know? And most of these people had repeated attempts at getting clean. And I hear often, they just weren't ready to do the work. They didn't have enough pain. And for me, that's baloney. Every time I came in, I'd had enough pain. I was willing to do the work. And oftentimes I did do the work, but I just didn't have a life that was worth staying clean for. You know? I've created this life now that's so incredible. Like, I get to get up and I get to help people through music every day. I get to go to detox and play classical music. We have a partnership with a special needs facility on South Congress where I get to go in and I get to do an open mic with these beautiful, loving, amazing human beings. And it just reminds me that I am not the center of the universe. There's always people that are going to have it a lot worse than me. And, you know, along with some really good therapy this year, I've done the work and my life has become very, very good. I want to especially mention, like, relationships. Like, Chris was one of the first people I met when I got to Austin at Sober Gym. And, you know, Chris and I have gone out and talked a few times. He's come and played with us, and I've come and played with them. And, like, you know, I have a commitment now to show up at Sober Gym and be a part of this thing, you know? Commitments, you know, something that I never, ever had when I was out getting high. And these days, I have all these cool little commitments that keep me on track. If I ever had a day where I thought of really about using or drinking, I would remember my little friend Lily, the other Lily, who's out in Smithville, who's 8 years old, with cerebral palsy, and who sent me a video of her watching me play the violin in her leg braces and saying that, you know, this helps her. This helps with her pain, you know, and I was the absolute definition of a selfish addict. You know, I could not get clean. And these days, that's the kind of text messages I get with some kids, you know, that appreciate that I've showed up for them, you know, that I've made a little bit of a difference in somebody's life. And that, to me, is the definition of recovery. Thank you guys so much for having me.